Once again, the wisdom of Solomon to address this crazy and so-called modern culture we live in. Yes, you're listening to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. And as we do every week, we're going to look at the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon and see how it can help us to combat and maybe even change the confused culture we live in today. If you want to give us your thoughts and opinions during the show, you can give us a call, studio number 520-750-7456. Fred's out today, but should be back next week with his usual wit and wisdom, although he did say he might call in for the first part of the show, so we'll see what happens there. A reminder, if you want to listen to a previous show, you can find them on our website, solomononblast.com, and if you want to stream us live right now, from your smartphone or tablet or whatever, just follow the Power Talk 1210 link in the upper right corner of the page, and it'll take you to the Power Talk 1210 website, where you can stream the show. I happened to run across an article on the web that referred to a book called The Dictionary of Modern Proverbs. The book is put out by Yale University Press, so I thought, maybe there's a little bit of wisdom in there. Got me to thinking about the fact we have all this modern technology, the internet, smartphones, Google, Wikipedia, but is there really any modern wisdom coming from all that technology? The article I mentioned listed some of the modern proverbs from the dictionary, so I thought, why not see if these modern proverbs have any wisdom and if they really are modern proverbs? Not just quotations. Remember, there is a difference between just a quotation and a proverb. Quotation is just something somebody said, might have wisdom, might not, might be memorable or funny, but and you might find a proverb in a book of quotations, but book of proverbs won't have those useless quotations. Some of them are useless at times. One source I found described a proverb as a short, pithy saying in frequent and widespread use expressing a well-known truth or fact which offers advice or presents a moral. And in the case of Solomon, it also provides wisdom. This particular article I was reading listed some of the proverbs from this dictionary, and the first one listed was a familiar one, which is probably why it was listed first. The proverb was, "No harm, no foul." Now, this one, if you're a basketball player or fan, you know, refers to the fact that a player shouldn't be called for a foul against another player if he didn't harm his opponent anyway. It gets used in a lot of other instances as well, and it's fairly well known. So you might say, yeah, this is a modern proverb because it refers to a basketball rule, or at least rules maybe in a pickup game of basketball, and basketball is a fairly modern sport. But the question I had and have for you is it really a modern proverb? I thought about Solomon's wisdom in the book of Proverbs and thought there was something about this no harm, no foul that seemed very familiar. And then it came to me. Do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. Proverbs 3:30. No harm, no foul? A modern proverb? I don't think so. It's just modification of Solomon's proverb, and it says the same thing. So once again, Solomon's right. There really is nothing new under the sun. The thing about our confused culture today, though, is that the concept behind this proverb, whether as Solomon said it, do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm, or this modern version, no harm, no foul, seems to be either ignored or turned upside down. We have a culture where strife seems to be the norm, and in most cases, it's without cause, and when there's been no harm. Just look at the news. There's always somebody that's all upset about being harmed, but the harm they claim usually turns out to be nothing more than their feelings getting hurt, and only in their eyes. And worse, it's typically something that a reasonable person would respond with, just get over it. But in today's confused culture, it becomes a big deal. Something that results in everybody else having to accommodate that person's feelings. And when there has been no harm, especially when there has been no harm. So instead of real justice for real cases where there is harm, we end up with social justice forcing everybody else to accommodate one person where there was no harm. That's what happens when real wisdom is forgotten. My view of it is this way. When men follow God's wisdom, they seek a just society. But when men reject God's wisdom, they seek social justice. That's the confused culture we live in today, and it's why we do this show, to help you remember not to strive with a man without cause if he's done you no harm. No harm, no foul. It used to be the case, but not in this day of feelings over wisdom. So, we'll be back with more of Solomon on Blast right after this commercial break. Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Yep, going to the chapel to get married, supposedly. Ecclesiastes 3:16-17 says, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every purpose and for every work." So, what am I talking about? Well, what can't you... What is the big topic this week? Of course, it's the decision by the Supreme Court of the United States making marriage, same-sex marriage, legal nationwide, all 50 states. Now, it turns out that Fred was able to call in, so we've got him on the guest line. Fred, check, are you there?
Yeah, good morning, Doug. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. Good morning, Fred. So this is a landmark ruling. According to this article, says it will produce the most significant change in laws governing matrimony since the court struck down state bans on interracial marriage almost 50 years ago. So, is it...
Right. Even that headline is completely misleading because many states and previous civilizations and different times have always had some kind of marriage law that accommodated people from different ethnicities. I mean, so they're trying to make, obviously, a connection between racial equality and gay rights, which can be kind of maddening to people that have had to actually deal with real ethnic prejudices.
Right. And in the statement that Kennedy wrote, it says, "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than they once were." As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. Now, this...
Yeah, now, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's flowery and encouraging as all of that sounds. I think, in this case, Justice Roberts had it right when he was saying, well, basically, it's okay to celebrate, but you're certainly not celebrating the Constitution. The United States Supreme Court fundamentally has usurped the power of the people, and that's pretty much what Robert said, in order to legislate from the bench. And now it's finally reached the highest court in the land, and there's really I'm sorry, Doug, there's a real feeling of desperation when you see that it really doesn't matter what the people say anymore. It doesn't matter how they vote. You know, even going back to 1996 with the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed by President Clinton,
right?
In fact, that this was something that Congress, at both houses, agreed upon. So we're not just talking about, you know, some archaic law that was kind of on the books, like the sodomy law of the past. We're talking about something that has been an issue front and center in American culture that the people over and over and over again have spoken on. When I was living in California, I was there when they did two different props, Prop 8 and Prop 22. And in both cases, California, the cities with San Francisco and Hollywood, for crying out loud, in both cases chose to support traditional marriage. So what we see here is a political usurpation that is astonishing. It makes your head turn on what we just witnessed. It basically, I don't know how else to say it, you can't come out of this without losing faith in the in our democracy.
So you don't think that maybe, like I started out with, that the proverb of don't, contend with somebody if they've done you no harm is really applicable here, that in general, these people aren't doing anybody any harm, so should we really be contending with them?
It's an interesting, it's kind of a long shot connection, you might say, but there is a connection in this. Yesterday morning, and pardon the phrase, but the ACLU came out of the closet as well and made a statement that religious freedom is no longer a freedom they defend. So all along, what you see here is not merely people looking to be acknowledged and, marry whoever they want. There is an all-out front right now against religion, what I would call serious-minded religion, traditional religion, people that have truly believe and live their lives around their faith and their belief system. Those people of any sort are under attack, and they've made it very clear now that this has been executed. And I don't even like to say pass, because this whole court was stacked for this very reason. And here's another issue, Doug, I'll just throw out there.
Okay.
Justice Ginsburg, for example.
Right.
Justice Ginsburg, back in 2013, she officiated a gay wedding. Now, knowing that this case was on the horizon, in another time, that might have been called a conflict of interest. And a justice might have been forced to recuse themselves from a case that contradicted, their personal involvement. But not a word out of anybody. Well, there were a few that spoke up about this. But what really troubled me is how the Republican Party themselves did not stand up and contend with all of these factors along the way.
So it's, in some people's mind, it's very much related to religion, but is it really more related to the secular legal aspect of marriage, in that these people, their claim was, they don't have the same rights in terms of being able to go see their loved one if they're in a hospital. They don't have the same rights in terms of aspect of taxes and that kind of stuff. So was it really more this is more really a legal, secular legal change than it is a change in the aspect of religion or marriage from a religious point of view?
It's interesting that you say that. I remember discussing this with people during 15 years ago or so, and the what I would call people that were just simply sympathetic and well-wishing and good intentions, this was their argument. Exactly what you just said. They deserve, if they're spending their life with a partner, they deserve access to the insurance policies and all that kind of stuff. And there's a certain amount of that made sense, but then domestic partnership became accepted around many states, and a lot of that seemed to address the financial aspect. I think what we're seeing here, Doug, this is not about finances. It's not even about self-acceptance anymore. It's about overturning Judeo-Christian tradition. That's what this is all about. And they're not going to stop. And they're coming after it, and they're coming after it hard. And you realize that there's a real agenda, and I think most everyday, decent, working-type family people that were a little incredulous. I mean, it couldn't be this bad. They couldn't really be that radical in their they just want to be happy. They just want to be accepting. And you realize, not true. Not true. They are coming, as the ACLU declared, they no longer defend religious freedom. This is what they've been after all along. And this is going to be a very interesting time that we face. that were. But let me just say this: one of the things that they've done very well in the same-sex marriage agenda has been isolating this as an issue of religion only, as if it just has to do with someone's personal faith. But one thing that they have not allowed people to consider is that its impact upon, on nature itself. And that what I mean by that is just how society is impacted, you know, how our democracy is impacted. In fact, Justice Scalia, I think he made the statement that should cause everyone to tremble about if you love your country. And Justice Scalia said this is a threat to American democracy. Most people will just dismiss that as hyperbole. But, Doug, that's not hyperbole. This is going to have an impact on everything we are and everything we do. And you can only imagine what the family structure will be like in 50 years as things move forward with this kind of impact, things that we simply take for granted. If you ask me, it's more alarming than people would even know. I know most people today, they're thinking about their vacations. But I think that's one of the reasons why it comes out in times like this, because people aren't really thinking about it.
Well, we've talked about it a little bit in the past that really percentage-wise, it's a very, very small percentage of people that this really benefits, I guess if you want to say from that aspect of it being a benefit. And we know that there were already 36 states that permitted it, so it's not really a significant increase in the number of states that are being told to do it, other than the fact that they are being told to do it by the federal government, and it should be a state's choice, not the federal government's. But is it really going to be that big of an impact, knowing that there aren't that many people out there that are going to partake of this?
Well, the impact part of it is that it is symbolically an amazing victory. When you go to the highest court in the land, and the highest court puts their blessing upon it, then the legal implications from there are just enormous going forward, you know. One of the things that we've seen over and over again, and we've discussed this in the past about guns or whatever, is they shop out situations.
Right.
And they look for opportunities to file lawsuits. And so now the churches have to gear up. Churches that have traditional positions on marriage, which is exactly what the church and the synagogue are for, you know, to take certain positions in secular culture and to maintain those positions because they fear God, not man, are going to have to face probably waves of assault on certain locales, certain local congregations.
But
get ready, put on your seatbelt. They're coming after everything they can find. What I'm trying to say over and over again, this is not merely about trying to be accepted, trying to have a place. They've abandoned that tack probably a decade and a half ago.
Well,
maybe two.
When it comes,
this is about dominion.
When it comes to the religious aspect of it, it would seem to me that we have a pretty good ground to stand on with regards to the separation of church and state, and we get that impact from the secular world that we can't have religion within the schools or anything else because it's of the separation of church and state. Well, marriage in the traditional sense is a church view, and it's a church covenant and institution. So if we can use that, just like the other side's doing with regards to not allowing prayer in the schools, then we've got a pretty good dog in the fight here that just says, look, you can't force anything under the guise of separation of church and state.
That's if that continues to hold. But then I'm telling you, that is within their view right now. Those kind, you know, the First Amendment and all of that is in their view. Second Amendment's in their view. They make no bones about that. Why not the First? I just read an article today. I think it was posted on Drudge that there are certain pages that will not allow any anti-same-sex marriage position anymore, you know, as a matter of policy. So, you know, these again, I think most everyday decent, hardworking people who kind of scan news headlines and, you know, they care, but they don't pay this kind of attention to these realities. And it's something worth, when Judge, again, Scalia says that it's a threat to our democracy, I don't think he's blowing smoke. I think he's really speaking from the platform that he, you know, functions upon to say, watch out, folks, put on your seatbelt. I'll say one other thing, Doug, before I let you go here. And I'll say this. I think part of the blame goes to the Republican Party. Savage says, who's now on to our top 12-10, by the way, he said, we have no opposition party. And they did not fight. They did not hold the line. They could have made some impact. They could have gone after the Ginsburg issue. They could have made hay out of that. They could have pushed up some issues in all of this. But they just over and over again continuously take a step back, take another step back, take another step back. And I never thought I'd say this, but this issue that maybe it's time for a third party. I really believe maybe it's time. I know the Tea Party tested the waters and made it fantastic for a period of time. And, of course, they were completely demonized by the media.
Of course.
With every hateful slur you can imagine against just usually most of these regular American people. And they got isolated off into the certain corners of American life. But if there could be a family party in America that could appeal to that and had the ability to cross ethnic boundaries, which the Republicans just can't do very well. And, you know, there's a lot of ethnic people in the Republican Party that are rooting that somehow one day, you know, but yeah, I'm starting to believe that they're inept and that they'll never do that. And that they're stuck on Jeb Bush and those kinds of candidates forever.
Right.
And I'm worried. You know, you think about the guy who really decided this, Justice Kennedy. You know, going back, he was a Gerald Ford appointee.
Yeah.
You know, this is the kind of stuff the Republicans have been doing to America over and over again. Roberts on Obamacare. These are Republican appointees that are not getting it done.
Thanks, Fred. Break's coming up, 5 seconds. I appreciate the input. We'll be back with more of Solomon on Blast right after this. You just slip out the
back, Jack. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
We're back with more Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Obviously, we didn't give Fred enough time there to finish his last thought, but he'll be back next week. I'm sure we'll be able to discuss that. In this next story, Proverbs 29:9, Solomon says, if a wise man contends with a foolish man, whether the fool rages or laughs, there is no peace. And it seems like it goes back to the theme that I started with, that if there's been no harm done, why do we feel we have to strive against somebody? Well, the University of California system is basically doing that from the aspect of putting in place what they consider to be a threat, or what they're basically doing is putting together a system that is a threat to free speech, and they're doing it in order to avoid this terminology called microaggression, where through different little things you say, you might actually be supposedly harming somebody. There's an article in the LA Times that says it's troubling when any institution tries to squelch debate or discourage controversial ideas, but it's downright alarming when it occurs at our university, and even worse when it's the University of California, whose Berkeley campus was the center of this free speech movement in the 60s. Yet that's exactly what's happening with this what the article refers to as a heavy-handed sensitivity training about so-called microaggressions. University instructors everywhere should feel free to say that America is a land of opportunity, or that affirmative action is racist, or that a student of any race or gender is good in math, without having to worry that they might inadvertently be offending someone. But UC officials should understand that and stop trying to defend their over-the-top, politically correct list of unacceptable topics and questions. And those particular phrases, this land of America being a land of opportunity, or the fact that you may be good in math, those are material posted on the website of the office of the UC president, who just so happens to be somebody we all remember around here in Arizona, Janet Napolitano. But it's supplemental material to workshops that the deans and the department's heads had been invited to attend. The goal of it was legitimate, to increase awareness of racist or sexist comments that might be made unintentionally. And some of the examples certainly could have that particular effect. But other ones, such as saying to somebody like a black woman, "I would have never guessed that you were a scientist," shouldn't really be considered racist. But some of these other ones, they're not aggressive at all. But that seems to be the case over what they believe is going on here, is that just by making certain statements that they're causing problems within a person's environment. They're harming that person. If a professor asks a Latino, Asian American, or Native American student to speak up more in class, is the professor really saying that they must assimilate to the dominant culture? If a university official says, "I believe the most qualified candidate should get the job," does that really mean people of color are given unfair benefits? So worse yet, the material that's posted on this UC website discourages faculty members from expressing legitimate political opinions. A professor ought to be able to say America is a melting pot, which is, again, one of these statements that they felt was microaggression, or that affirmative action is a bad policy because it is inherently racist. So what are these universities really afraid of? It seems like it's more about being politically correct than it is about just making comments to somebody. And given that this is on, like the article states, this is on the Berkeley campus where the whole free speech movement came about, it's interesting that they're so against free speech when it comes to anything that isn't politically correct.
I think they're against specific speech. I mean, anytime somebody tries to be politically correct, typically it's they want to be correct to a specific political agenda. I mean, just those words, like affirmative action, being against affirmative action. I benefited from a couple of affirmative action programs. I didn't benefit directly from like school or anything, but I remember getting into a summer program that was built specifically just for minorities, and I remember in that interview, they asked me, "What do you think of affirmative action?" I said, "I think it's worthless." You know, and these people are practicing. I mean, this program is a result of affirmative action, and I'm sitting there telling them, "I think it's complete nonsense." You know, and that's how I feel, and I have the right to feel that way. Right. I still want to be a part of the summer program, and I was. You know, and so that's free speech. Free speech is for me to be able to disagree with your political inclinations, but still understand that, you know, I think I ended that comment with something like, you know, I understand its use. I understand. I don't think it's perfect. I think we can come up with something better. I'm not saying it's evil. And so it's a way of kind of having at least a moderate mentality and being able to argue a point without being villainized. That's what free speech is. But this isn't free speech.
No, this is more, like I said, it's more about the concern that saying something, it's that liberal idea that everybody's harming somebody, some minority in some way, by making any kind of statement that somebody's defined as being aggressive. And I go back to who gets to make those definitions as to what is and isn't an aggressive statement. And maybe if this policy is in place there on the UC campus, that maybe some of the people that are Republicans or maybe more of the conservatives should turn it around and use it against the university itself when they make snide comments with regards to maybe Reagan or Bush or Christianity. You know, they can give them a little bit of their own medicine. Maybe that'll solve the problem there.
Right. So if and when Christianity becomes a religious minority, are they going to defend, are they going to outlaw saying Jesus Christ before and after or even just as a curse word? Is that going to be on the list?
Yeah.
Let's check.
Make sure. All right. So there's a little more of that if you've contend with somebody when there's been no harm. You know, why are we doing that? Well, like I said at the beginning, our culture seems to have been turned upside down, and everything that isn't a harm has been defined to be a harm. And those things that are truly harming us, they claim it isn't hurting us at all. We'll be back. More Solemn Non-Blast right after these messages. Okay, where am I? All right, we're back with more Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, "For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten." Well, question is, what is it like to be declared dead by the government? Turns out that it can be pretty painful, to say the least. In August 2010, communications specialist Judy Rivers went to her local bank to open a new account. As the clerk input her personal information, everything seemed to be going smoothly, but then the woman behind the desk stopped abruptly and frowned. "That's odd," she said. "There seems to be an issue regarding your Social Security number." With a glance, the employee rose, went back to the back room, came back a little bit later with the branch manager and said, "Your Social Security number was deactivated in 2008 due to death. So Rivers responded with, "You're trying to tell me I've been dead for 2 years and no one bothered to tell me." Well, her plight is what they call a falsely categorized deceased person. And it's not just an isolated case. It's estimated that every year some 12,200 very much alive U.S. citizens are declared dead by the Social Security Administration due to what they call keystroke errors.
Conspiracy.
Yeah. Those affected quite literally become walking dead, unable to secure a job, make financial transactions, file taxes, or visit the doctor, and for months on end must endure the nightmare of convincing the large bureaucracy that they haven't yet bit the dust. Now, this is definitely a case of there's been a little bit of harm here. No harm, no foul, not in this particular situation. But at birth, most individuals get their Social Security number, and while the number's main purpose is to subtract Social Security contribution, it also becomes, you know, mostly a national ID card, essentially. But it's also designed to keep track of the dead, and since 1980, it's maintained what is called the Death Master File, a database of more than 86 million deceased Social Security number holding Americans. And when you're medically recorded as dead, you're included in this master file and your Social Security number is retired, disabling any future use. And then a few weeks later, Medicare, the IRS, law enforcement, and employers essentially scratch you out of existence. In 2011, the Office of the Inspector General conducted an audit of this file and found that between May of 2007 to April of 2010, 36,657 living people had been prematurely added, nulling them and making them legally dead. Now, after a little more analysis, they estimated that between 700 to 2,800 people were erroneously declared every month since the list's inception. So over the 35-year history, they suspect that more than 500,000 Americans have been affected by this. And they actually had a nice little chart that showed by state how many people in the population out of 100 per 100,000 actually are considered to be in that death master file. If you're in Arizona here, there's about 6 to 7 people out of every 100,000 that happen to fall into that death master file. And most of those are really just a result of clerical errors. And it's something that has created a lot of problems for people, especially people like this lady here. She learned the hard way. She had to go before the Senate Committee on Homeland Security in March of this year and relayed her story. She says, "I could have never imagined I would reach the point of hopelessness, homelessness, loss of reputation and credibility, unable to obtain a job, an apartment, a student loan, or even a cell phone. Suspected as an identity theft by every apartment manager or human resource director I encountered became a way of life. Each time I got into my car, I was panic-stricken that the police would stop me and I would have to try and prove my identity." So she was in a state of financial destitution because of this.
She lost her home because of this?
Basically, she lost everything because she was dead. So consequences of being what they call a credit zombie can be pretty severe. So a lot of people have had this situation occur. An 83-year-old woman had her Social Security checks discontinued, and she couldn't purchase her medication. A man was fired from his job after a medical thief left drug addiction and narcotic medications in his records. And a young mother found out that an identity theft had purchased a $400,000 home using her information. So,
wow.
Another lady in New Hampshire found she was dead while attempting to get a driver's license at the DMV. She'd been, quote, killed due to a loan typo by an administrator. And she said, "I started to laugh when they told me that, but I really had no idea what a big deal it would become." So we've got the government bureaucracy that can just erase you from the face of the earth. And I think in that particular situation, you have every right to say foul and harm, as opposed to no harm, no foul, and we shouldn't contend against somebody in that situation.
Maybe it's the government's way of decreasing the Social Security deficit.
Yeah, maybe.
Removing people they have to pay to. I think I heard of this similar thing here. Somebody in Arizona that was declared dead, and it took them a while, but I think they finally got it. I think it was a name issue that somebody else with the same name died, and so they were able to resolve it like in 2 or 3 years. But this lady seems like she's been going on for
quite a long time. Now? Yeah. Seven? So it's kind of incredible that the Social Security Administration in 2015 doesn't have the sophistication to ensure whether people are alive or dead. So watch out there. You might just become one of the walking dead with regards to the Social Security Administration. So we'll come back after this quick break with our One Greater Than Solomon segment here on Solomon on Blast.
the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Swift sword, his truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps.
Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. In this One Greater Than Solomon segment, I thought I'd try, try and set the record straight with regards to what really was going on in the South during the Civil War. We hear everybody saying that that Confederate flag has to go, but is that really what was going on? Is that really is all the Confederate flag really all about hate and slavery and everything? Well, I don't think that's the case. And a little bit of evidence to go along with why. There's a book called Christ in the Camp, or Religion in the Confederate Army, written by Reverend J. William Jones, actually written back in 1887. And it's the history of religion and Christianity in the Confederate Army and the Christian revivals which took place in the Confederate States armies during the Civil War. And in this book, he talks about what was going on and some of the things that were seen related to the Confederate Army. And he actually talks about Stonewall Jackson, General Stonewall Jackson, who was very much a Christian. He said Jackson was one of the, and I'm going to read from some of this from the book, so there's probably some words in here that won't fly in today's world, but that's the way it's going to go. Jackson was one of those most thoroughly conscientious masters who ever lived. He not only treated his Negroes kindly, but he devoted himself most assiduously to their religious instruction. He was not only accustomed, as were Christian masters generally at the South, to invite his servants into family prayers, but he also had a special meeting with them every Sunday afternoon in order to teach them the scriptures. He made this exercise so interesting to them that other Negroes of the town craved the privilege of attending, and he soon had his room full of overflowing, eager pupils. This suggested to him the idea of organizing a Negro Sunday school, which he did several years before the war, and to which he devoted all of the energies of his mind and all of the zeal of his large Christian heart. Now, the book goes on to talk about the fact that as he was getting ready to go off to the start of the Civil War, he was very distraught that it was going to be on a Sunday and he wouldn't be able to teach his last class that he would always do on Sundays. And after he had gone off to the war, he actually had sent back a letter, and everybody was hoping that it would talk about what was happening within the battles and everything, and they would get a firsthand account from General Stonewall Jackson. But when they opened the letter, instead of the talk about the battles, there was a check for $50, which was to buy books for his colored Sunday school, and was filled with inquiries after the interest of the school and church. He writes, he had no time or inclination to write of the great victory and the imperishable laurels he was winning, but he found time to remember his noble work among God's poor and to contribute further to the good of the Negro children, whose true friend and benefactor he always was. Now, there was one other particular piece of this that was very interesting. After he had been brought back and his grave was at his graveside, there was a young colored boy who belonged to his Sunday school who had procured a Confederate flag, gotten someone to copy a stanza of the favorite hymn which he had taught him, and put it on his grave of his loved teacher. So it's not always about what the media tells you. So just remember, until next week, think wisely.